30 days in the county jail. Hold my calls, hold my mail. Serving soup, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. I have a shop on a street in town where hungry folks walk up and down. Some have no homes, some sick from want. So I went and got some food from a restaurant. I took it to a central spot to feed the weary something hot. The police came, took me away. Now for my awful deed I must now pay with 30 days in the county jail. Hold my calls, hold my mail. Serving soup, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. They said I needed a permit to serve free food. It must be fit. Now here I am awaiting trial while the hungry have to eat from the garbage pile. It's 30 days in the county jail. Hold my calls, hold my mail. Serving soup, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. I faced the judge and I made my plea. He looked away when he sentenced me. He said, we won't put you in the hole if you promise not to feed another living soul. I told that judge I could not say that crazy law I would obey, nor pay no fine or post no bail. Now I'm feeding folks inside the county jail. 30 days in the county jail. Hold my calls, hold my mail. Serving soup, that was my crime, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. Well now, Ollie North lied under oath. He lied to the judge and the Congress both. He was running drugs for the Contra War, but they locked me up because I fed the poor. Our leader, George, you know he might be right when he sees 1,000 points of light with kindler, gentler hearts like mine. But now there's just 999. 30 days in the county jail. Hold my call, hold my call. Hold my mail, serving soup, that was my crime, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. Yeah.
That is great, and you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, Bathrobe Spears Broadside, Civil Rights for Everybody in Town. And we have a recorded version of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides because the station is in motion at the moment. As you will hear later in an interview on this show, I hope, if I can get the proper taped segment on, Free Radio Santa Cruz is under not only eviction, but observation. It's being evicted by landlords, and it's being observed by the Federal Communications Commission, which may be attempting to snatch its equipment. Thus far, Free Radio Santa Cruz has avoided that eventuality. You've been listening to Mark Levy's song, 999 Points of Light, which I got from him directly, but was later placed on an album called Heroes, Sheroes. Of course, it was called 999 Points of Light for all you old-timers who may remember President Bush and his statement that private charity could provide 1,000 points of light, so why bother with government expenditures to help the poor? I guess President Clinton is proceeding with that legacy with his signing of the Welfare Deformation Destruction Bill yesterday. He hasn't signed it, but he's expressed his intention to sign it, which caused a landslide vote in favor of the bill in the House, and it's passed both houses now. Anyway, Mark Levy did this good song about serving soup and about Sandy Loringer, who's used to call her Sly Shoes Sandy. She's still around Santa Cruz. She's a woman about, what, 5 or 6 years older than I am, who just decided to start helping poor people. She's sat in at the River Street Shelter to open up the annex. She served food to the homeless with the SWAP team in 1989, Soup Without a Permit, a group that continued to serve people meal after meal, sometimes smuggling it in at the town clock when Mayor Marty Wormhout and her city council decided they wanted to stop the homeless from being publicly fed, and the county health department was sicked on the food operation. An injunction was gotten from the county health department, and numerous people were tried, including Brian Staley, Sandy Loringer, Jane Immler, and then a number of the rest of us were also slated to be tried, but by the time that September rolled around, we were arrested in January and then tried in September of 1989, or that's when the trials were set for, the city had decided, hey, we've had enough of this. They got lots of bad publicity as far away as India. Sandy Loringer, however, was convicted of serving free food to the homeless, sentenced to 45 days in jail, and I think she served either 23 or 27 here in Santa Cruz in the county jail, and this song was about her. I recently, as probably you already know, if you've been listening to this station, served 28 days in the county jail out of a 59-day sentence for serving food in San Francisco without a permit with Food Not Bombs. And hopefully I will be the last such case, although there was another individual, Carrie Chandler in Whittier, California, who was slated to go to trial a couple of days ago, and we still haven't gotten word as to what's happened down there in Whittier, California, which is where that trial is going to be happening. We'll give you more news on that when it happens. In the meantime, just hum along with 30 Days in the County Jail with singer Mark Levy. If you're interested in buying his tape, give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. That's my home phone number. That's also the number you can call if you want to be on the air, comment or criticize or add to or subtract from anything that I have said or any of my guests have said. There's also, of course, usually a call-in number to the station, 427-3772. That number, however, may be on hold at the moment. So if you want to leave me a message, try the 423-4833 number. We've got lots of recorded stuff coming up and relatively recent stuff, so I encourage you to stay tuned. This is probably going to be a loop tape that will be repeated throughout the day at different times when the masters of the studio machinery, I'm not sure where the studio is, whether it's being floated above the city on a dirigible, buried underground in some hemp field, or possibly stashed away in somebody's closet. Where it may be to foil FCC investigators and overeager landlords, but you should be getting the signal. And if you're getting the signal, listen in and let me know what you think of the show. 423-HUFF. Let's begin this session of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides with an interview with Food Not Bombs activist Keith McHenry, who we frequently have on the show. He's a San Francisco soup server who's been spending time in Atlanta, Georgia, with the second international gathering of Food Not Bombs in that city, simultaneous with the Olympics, the Olympic bombing, and the police removal of the homeless people from Atlanta. But he's back in San Francisco. We may even be able to dredge up a tape of his Atlanta experiences. But here's his latest update from San Francisco.
Rain?
Yes.
Well, good morning.
How's it going?
Well, how's it going with you?
Not too bad.
You're probably in the midst of your next European tour project?
I'm getting started on that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what's that all about?
Oh, well, so far I've got, I guess I'm meeting in, speaking to at a rally on the 20th up against,
20th of August?
Of September.
Uh-huh. So you're going to be here for a while, huh?
Well, for 21 days.
Mm-hmm. Well, so how long are you going to be in Europe?
Well, just 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Is this part of your plan to import hashish with the carrots, or?
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We have our eye on you, McHenry.
Did you like the Olympics?
You know, I didn't see one event. Actually, I did see one event. I happened to be standing in front of a television when some characters are doing gymnastics, but that's the only thing I saw of the Olympics. I'm not really much of a sports guy. So, what about you? Did you plant that bomb, Keith?
Well, we're waiting to see if I did.
Oh, I see.
If I did or not.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on what the official word ends up being.
This probably stemmed from a grammatical problem with the name of your group.
Right.
Got switched around and they are kind of jumbled up in the rumble seat of your car.
That was really funny because, well, the next day, of course, everybody thought, wow, what a good idea to have a name, Food Not Bombs.
Really?
Like they thought that, a lot of people thought, at least 8 people approached us saying that they, you know, with the indication that we had made up the name that night. Made this huge banners in them so fast.
I see. So you told them you were way ahead of them.
Yeah, we're
like 15 years ahead of them, or 17 years ahead of them. So I heard from a certain undisclosed sources that it was the whole Atlanta gathering was rather less of a success than the UN gathering a year ago of Food Not Bombs. This international gathering actually ended up feeding itself rather than many people, and that it was kind of a different sort of affair than the UN 50th anniversary gathering last year.
Oh, it was slightly different, but it was very positive, and we did feed, usually about 100 people. Well, when we were downtown, we'd feed 100 homeless people.
How often was that?
Probably about the same idea as the UN 50, as far as that.
You mean you could actually find homeless people in Atlanta?
Yeah, well, see, what turned out was that all the soup kitchens were shut down, and the shelters were shut down. Well, 3 of them were bulldozed.
Really?
Actually, that's where Centennial Park is.
Oh, there have to be sacrifices made, Keith.
Yes. So Centennial Park is on the land where the shelters used to be. And that used to be about probably around, 300 or 400 up to maybe, 800 homeless people in that exact scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up finding, a lot of the people came. It turned out that the police really weren't hassling the homeless because the police were completely disorganized.
Really?
Yeah, they didn't know what was up. And it was, pretty obvious when you could see how they had, one actual bombing and a bunch of, I guess they found some pipe bombs around.
Hmm.
But,
did anyone ever take responsibility for any of those bombs?
No one has.
But you took responsibility for the food, eh?
Yeah, we took it. And the people were really supportive of us that were going to the Olympics. I thought they would hate us.
Mm-hmm.
But the Olympics were so poorly organized and such a fiasco, and the whole thing was such an obviously glaring scam, that people cheered when we marched down the street.
Really? In what way was it poorly organized, and how would you call it a clear scam?
Well, first of all, there was claimed that there was going to be around 2 million people or more attending
mm-hmm.
who come to Atlanta. So there were some vendors near downtown that had put up, $10,000 for a permit to have a tent on the Auburn Street or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then by the end of the first day, they made brought in $25. One guy sold 8 hot dogs, and he paid $10,000 and put in $20,000 worth of his money to buy all this stuff to sell, and no one bought it.
What about by the end of the period?
Well, by the time I left, most of the vendors had completely shut down, and their tents were blowing around in the streets, and the signs were, like, just, you know, in the gutters and stuff like that.
Had the homeless occupied the tents as housing, perhaps?
They weren't really suitable for housing.
But the
whole, like, Sweet Auburn, which is this one shopping district that right off of the, really near downtown, there wasn't any vendors at all left by even day five. Most of the vendors had left because there was just nothing there. And nobody walking by, no one buying anything. And, you know, the prices were really super high because if you were down around Centennial Park or right in downtown, permits were as much as $50,000.
Mm-hmm. Did these people make any money?
No, hundreds and hundreds of people definitely lost everything that they had.
And there's been no story about this nationally?
Very little story about it, no. I stood in front of a booth. Well, we had, like, these amazing protests. The other thing was that that the Atlanta left was completely disorganized and screwed up and
mm-hmm.
didn't show up to its own events. So they had, like, this big protest that we've been hearing about on the first 2 days. When we got there, and there were seven people there.
Seven people?
Yeah.
Sounds like one of our protests.
Yeah, this huge, giant protest, only seven people.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the free speech area, and they had a permit. It was in front of the state house, Stateville Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
And the 40, 50 Food and Avant people showed up, of course, made it into a real protest. So then eventually some local people came at 8 o'clock at night, but the protest started at 10 in the morning. And so it was mostly just Food and Avant people sharing free food with passersby, and there was a lot of hungry people around there because there was no food.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we had water, and there was very little water.
And this was what, in late?
That was the 19th
of July.
Yeah, in the 20th of July, we went back because there was supposed to be a second day of protest at the Capitol. Well, at the end of that protest, actually, at 8 o'clock, or maybe 6:30, 7 o'clock, something like that, about 50 African-American people associated with the King Center came down. So we had, like, maybe 100 people there,
mm-hmm.
and they burned the Georgia flag.
Well, I remember reading something about that somewhere.
Yeah, that's the only thing that made the news.
But they claimed they were just burning the Confederate flag, not burning the Georgia flag.
Yeah, well, actually, they're burning... The Georgia flag is a Confederate flag.
Right, but they claimed that they weren't trying to burn the Georgia flag, they were just trying to burn the hated symbol of slavery.
The Georgia legislature in 1964 had made this new flag because they were opposed to desegregation,
mm-hmm.
and so it's a protest against that. So that was pretty cool, and then we burned the American flag, and then that was that. And then the next day we go down there, and there's, like, nobody, just Lorenzo Irwin was the only one there.
Who's that?
That's he's famous for he wrote a book on black autonomy, and he he hijacked a plane. He was with the Panthers, and he hijacked a plane to Cuba, and he did, like, 20 years in prison. And he's a really nice guy, fantastic guy. And we went and we picked him up and brought him to our house because there was nothing. It was just him, and we were worried that it would only be him. So we just, we didn't plan to do anything. And then we held a meeting, actually, that whole day and trying to organize ourselves and went out and got I had a workshop on pirate radio that I did about 50 people showed up to that.
How was pirate radio acting in San Antonio?
That was going really well, except for we lost our mixer after the first little while.
Well, I remember last year in San Francisco, you had a special broadcasting, a second station broadcasting from atop the, I don't know, was it the one of the floors of the building where people were gathering?
No, you got shut down.
Right, but what about in Atlanta? Did you have something similar?
Well, we had this house, a radio station going. It went pretty far because it was kind of on the hill.
Call-ins and so forth?
No call-ins, but just, like, us broadcasting and different people. We were doing we played punk music and read anti-Olympics flyers.
The center of your criticism of the Olympics had to do with the corporate backing and expense involved, or the environmental damage, or discrimination against the homeless, or all of these things?
All of those things, yeah. And the police repression. They had two police stations on plinths up above the... at all times, there's these huge blimps that said "Land of Police" on them.
You mean blimps like Zeppelins?
Yeah, as big as the same size as Goodyear blimps.
That's just a sort of easy access to machine gun fire.
It was weird. They're too high up to shoot at.
They could shoot back at you.
They could shoot at us. Easy.
They could drop oranges and tomatoes on you if they wanted to. It could be a great opportunity for Food Net Bombs to rent such a Zeppelin and then just start feeding the pigeons, for one thing.
The blimps were actually donated by Kroger's, which is the main grocery store chain in Atlanta.
But Kroger's...
They just painted out the word Kroger and put Atlanta Police in its place.
Ah, so revealing the real identity of Kroger's, perhaps?
Right, essentially that was what was going on. And Kroger's, of course, were big in exploiting people there. But it was mainly Coca-Cola, IBM, AT&T.
Did Coca-Cola come by in a friendly gesture distribute free Cokes at the Food Net Bombs meals?
The Cokes were only $3 to $5, depending on where you bought them.
Uh-huh.
So a 12-ounce can of Coke was like $3.
Inflation, I suppose.
Well, it's the holidays. And so only 50,000 people approximately showed, maybe 75,000 people out instead of the...
2 million prediction.
So then you would be at a restaurant, or you know, like we were going at this burrito place, and there was like nobody in the burrito place. We were the only ones there. It was supposed to be this hot part of town where everyone would want to go. Nothing happening. It was incredible.
How many people live in Atlanta?
There's supposed to be 2 million people, but most of them left.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they actually there was like something like over 50% vacancy rate on hotels. Not all the tickets were, you know, $300 ticket to the Olympics was being scalped for $12.
Wow.
You could park anywhere you want to. You could drive right up to a Olympic stadium and get out of your car, park in a park, and just on the street without even any meters, with nothing, and walk in. You know, it's like there was no traffic jams. You know, there was one brief, slight, slow time on Saturday night in the wealthy neighborhood. Buckhead, but otherwise there was no traffic jams. There was no problem at all. The only traffic jam that they had was exactly at the moment that Clinton would be in a motorcade from some Air Force base. There would be that exact highway would be shut down just temporarily for the motorcade to go by, but otherwise there was nothing going on. They canceled, like many of the concerts were just canceled, including the one that was where the bomb went off had been a $50 ticket concert that just ended up being canceled and made a free concert, and the main act just were told not to bother coming because no one bought any tickets.
Hold on for a second, Keith. Well, we're back again, and you were saying that times were tough for the poor promoters of the Atlanta Olympics.
Well, it certainly is a very combative atmosphere there. I guess one bright spot was that AT&T and Coca-Cola lost a lot of advertising revenue because they couldn't advertise for the whole day that the bombing was on TV. But maybe they attracted more viewers as a result of that.
They probably did, actually.
Yeah, it might be a wash in that regard. But there's certainly going to be a ton of lawsuits. The mayor, mayor is certainly going to be thrown out.
Because?
From this. Taxes are going to increase. Unemployment is already higher because of the Olympics. Thousands of people came there thinking there would be work, and they got there and there was no work. And what work there was, people got laid off from right away. There were all these empty booths, even on day five and day six. People just, you know, they couldn't pay their workers to staff the booths, and they just split because there was just no reason to be operating.
And how long were you there?
I was there for 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And the protests themselves were amazing. The Food Net Bombs people on the first day had this meeting, and we went out and bought a propane stove and all that. But people were sent out to, you know, we had figured out where the different bagel sources would be and food sources. And then we started cooking originally at the Bob's house. He's the man that founded Atlanta Food Net Bombs. And then it became pretty obvious that there's too many of us there, so we set up an outdoor kitchen at the old Carver George Washington Carver High School, which is now the office spaces for the Georgia Citizens Coalition on Hunger.
Mm-hmm.
And we had this whole outdoor facility, and we would meet there every morning at 11. And we had the first protest, which was already planned by the people in Atlanta, which we were the predominant participants in, the flag-burning protest.
Mm.
And then on the 19th and the 18th, I mean the 20th, that protest really didn't go off. But we shared food in Little Five Points in a big way, which is sort of the hippie area of, that's real close to downtown. And a fair number of tourists were there. We had this huge Food Not Bombs banner we tied between these trees. And there's, like by this time, maybe, you know, 75, 80 Food Not Bombs people had gathered. So there's this huge presence of us with all this food, and we had a literature table, and there's a lot of street people living in that neighborhood, so we fed all those people. And that, we even made, like, more, like, spaghetti and stuff later in the night from this rainbow bus that Harry Huggs lives on. And so that was amazing. And then the next day, we had our next protest planned, which was at the federal penitentiary in Atlanta, and that's where Alexander Berkman spent 2 years, and Eugene Debs was there for protesting the war. And
who's there now?
Right now, there was Puerto Rican independence activists who were doing like 30 and 40 year sentences, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also two people from the School of the Americas Watch, and Fort Benning, Georgia, which is, for instance, my father, when he was forced into the military. That's where he went to learn how to be an army man. And it's this horrible, hot, terrible, gross place.
I believe Bob Darby spoke about these two prisoners, how they were, what were they doing? They were protesting activities in El Salvador.
They were protesting the School of the Americas, which is also nicknamed the School of the Assassins. And one example, for instance, is that there is a protest coming up in mid-November that is predominantly church-based protest, in protest to the assassination of the Jesuit priest and their cook and her daughter, or child, I'm not sure whether it was a daughter, that were killed by people who had been trained at the School of the Americas. 19 of the people involved in that assassination.
Are we talking about 1989 killings or something?
Correct. And Archbishop Romero.
That was back in 1980.
Yeah, he was assassinated by graduate
79.
School. And of course, the death squads of El Salvador and of Guatemala.
So these two guys have been in jail, and I understand they keep going back to jail for the same kinds of things. They're exposing. They're there for trespass or misusing government property or something like that?
Right. They've been dressing in military uniforms and sneaking onto the base and handing out flyers to the people there on the base. And they actually have rented a house directly across from the base. And they've done things like the one man, Roy Bourgeois, who's doing 6 months and who's housed in Atlanta. In the we marched all around his penitentiary and stuff, and we had two of his supporters brought drums so that they could hear, you know, the prisoners could hear inside. That was very inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people drive by the Atlanta Federal Pen because it is in town, and it's this big, ugly building. And
did you go visit Bourgeois in jail, or?
We didn't get into jail to visit him, but we did, hold this protest, and we went to areas where he might potentially be able to see us from inside.
Did you serve oatmeal and raisins on the steps of the jail as you did on a certain other jail?
We didn't actually do that there. There wasn't, it's all people driving by. There's no real place for people to park at that place.
For the benefit of our listeners, Keith and his hearty gang of Food Not Bombs militants, a rather small gang in San Francisco, continued to serve food every morning, every weekday morning at the Hall of Justice while I was in jail for 28 days for serving free food. So I thought perhaps you might have expanded your operation and crossed state lines with intent to, conspire to serve lunch.
Well, we did do that. We had these huge meals that we served down. The next day we went down to Woodruff Park, Woodruff is the man who started Coca-Cola, or actually stole the idea of Coca-Cola from some poor guy that originally actually did start it. And it was a multi-billionaire, maybe only millionaire at the turn of the century, whatever. And he, so that park is near Centennial Park. It's about, it's on the other side of, it's one block away from Centennial Park.
Which is what, Central Park and where the Olympics are doing their thing? Or?
Right, and there's all these booths and everything there.
Mm-hmm.
And we set up this literature table, made all these banners and stuff. We had banners that said, like, free all U.S. political prisoners and enjoy corporate greed, that was painted in the, looked like the Coca-Cola logo and that kind of stuff. And then we had gone that morning to this one of the soup kitchen St. Luke's had reopened against the wishes of the people running the Olympics, but they were seeing homeless people. Their people were coming to buy, and they felt so that they couldn't just, you know, continue to stay shut down. So we went there and had our breakfast, and then asked people if they wanted to join us at Woodruff Park at 5. And a lot of people showed, about, I'd say between 75 to 100 people living on the streets came to eat, plus all the Food on Bonds people, and we went through this some huge amount of food. And then some of those people joined us in marching all around downtown, and we went past Centennial Park and past the stadiums. And
now, were you in the streets or on the sidewalk?
In the streets.
Wow.
Much against the, at first the police were trying to say, oh, you can't be here, you can't be there, but they lost kind of control of what was going on. And there was some of the, you know, it was unclear what was an actual road that was a pedestrian walkway and a road that was for cars, because, but we, you know, so a lot of the streets pedestrians could walk on anyway. And at one point, when we're going right past the Centennial Park, and there's this freeway ramp that had been completely blocked off, and all the people would be dropped off in these buses at this one point and walk on this freeway bridge to the main stadium and to the Georgia Dome and to the, it would go past the CNN world headquarters and stuff. And we just marched right down that street, that freeway, and there's thousands and thousands of people, like almost everybody going to the Olympics was in this little tiny several block area. And practically everyone saw our huge Food on Bonds banner and all of our other banners, you know, and corporate greed, all these things like that.
Did any visitors to the Olympics join you?
Some people joined us. They all often stood, but many, many people cheered and raised their fists in support of us and clapped. And we were very popular amongst the people going to the Olympics because it was so exploitive and so disgusting that even people who had bought their $300 tickets to go to the Olympics were completely mortified at what a commercial bunch of garbage the whole thing was. And we were able to get the word out that homeless people had been displaced, and that right where we were standing had been put soup kitchens and shelters, and that people had been arrested, and did not make the mainstream media, but the word got out through just us handing out flyers and us talking to people and us and having this huge presence of essentially it's having the 75 to 100 Food Not Bombs people marching around downtown, singing. We had, where, oh, where have the homeless gone? They've gone to make way for Olympic pride, things like that. We had all these chants, like homes not stadiums, food not profits, and people cheered us. It was that they weren't as brain dead
as you feared.
And because it was just so disturbing that people were really behind what we were doing. Then we had, the next day we had a kind of what we call the nude protest, where people taped dollar bills over their nipples and made like little shorts out of dollar bills and Coke logos and things like that, and marched around banging pots and pans, and that was really popular. And some people were saying, "Oh no, that's so embarrassing, people being scantily clothed," but it was very much like the Mud People, only with an anti-corporate emphasis.
Did the media cover any of this?
Of course not. We had some European media that was very interested in this, but the U.S. media was uniformly nasty when you would call them. They would give you a really hard time, even though we faxed systematically all the main U.S. media. We called they had like these special numbers you could call for the media, for the international desks and so on. And
so the Atlanta Constitution wasn't interested?
They gave me a hard time. They were like accusing this woman who had called us up 6 months ago, when I called, I was faxing her, and I called her back, and I finally got a hold of her, and she gave me this hard time. Why am I bothering her?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because we got protests. That's why we're bothering her.
Mm-hmm.
But, so they made it very clear that under no circumstances, they said, well, why protest the Olympics? What, this is, these are the games. You know, what, they were very, all the U.S. media was extremely rude, with the exception of Juliet Casson at ABC World News, but she never sent anybody to do anything. She was sympathetic, but the rest of the media was vicious, was like absolutely hostile.
There's a
what was interesting in the view of the fact that then there's this bombing, and we're the Food Not Bombs people, and we were this alternative to bombing, and not, we were a nonviolent thing, and of course the person who whatever the message is from the bomber will be like splattered endlessly all over the media,
mm-hmm.
only reinforcing the idea that the only way to be heard is by bombing people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're just making their own bed, and you know, because they had ample opportunity. We had very photogenic protests that were popularly supported, even by the people attending the Olympics, and yet we got no cover.
So you had a protest just about every day involving, what, about 100 people, or?
Right, about 100 people every single day, always, usually around, well, we had, sometimes in the afternoon, sometimes there's two protests, but definitely one, at least one every day. We had a, you know, because things were collapsing by the fifth day from the you know, people were missing their, you know, athletes weren't getting to their venues, the spectators couldn't get to where they're going, and the whole thing was completely botched. The all these homeless people were coming around, people who were not originally homeless in Atlanta, but who had come to Atlanta for jobs,
mm-hmm.
only to find that they didn't have jobs, or that they were laid off once they got there, because you know, because the people right away started realizing they were going to lose all their money, so it just, you know, gave up.
Mm-hmm.
Those people joined us, and there was this huge stage, temporary stage in Woodruff Park. And but it faced all these little vendors and all this pedestrian way where everyone went, would walk by on their way to Centennial Park and stuff. And so we put our Food Not Bombs banner across the face of it, and we became like this main event. You know, we were something that wasn't corporate, that was interesting. We had just tons of food, just amazing amounts of food that we gave.
Did many tourists sample your food?
Many tourists did come by and hang out with us and sample the food, because it was, and many workers that couldn't, that weren't homeless, but just couldn't afford to buy the stuff. You know, like I say, $5, like a Budweiser is $5, you know, and a Coke was $3. But after a while, that's, the prices of those things started going down too. There was, T-shirts were down to $5 on day five. They were, had been $20. Parking that was $20 was reduced to $5 and then to free.
Mm-hmm.
They charged $5 to go to what's called Atlanta Underground, which is this kind of phony department, this mall that's underground, where it's supposed to be related to the MARTA, which is the public transportation. There was $5 to go down there, but the people that had the shops organized a protest against that, and petition or something to... And it became free to go down there. There was many things like that, but that still didn't end up helping these vendors.
Mm-hmm.
The first 2 days were there, or the first 2 days before the Olympics, on the 17th and the 18th, about 200 people were arrested near the Georgia Dome.
For?
It's not clear what their charges were. They were arrested outside their own homes and just walking down the street. It's a predominantly African-American neighborhood. And this all-white security team that's that had been hired by the, the Atlanta Committee for the Olympic Games, was housed at this African-American school, Morehouse College, and they ended up in fights and physical communications with the neighbors, and resulting then in the arrest of the neighbors. And so that was one of the earliest phenomena that was happening. There's also a brand new jail was built as part of the preparations for the games. And that was filled to capacity, apparently, with the homeless people from Atlanta. So there was, like, a lot of people were just stuck in jail. There's also was these rumors, which I never could confirm, that the courts were shut down until the 5th of August, meaning that you could not get bailed. If you were arrested at any moment during the Olympics, you had to stay until after the Olympics before you could be bailed out. Like I say, that was a rumor. We talked to Bill Bondsman, and they were all open, but we didn't really know whether people were getting bailed or if it was a certain class of people that got bailed, or you know, maybe you could get bailed by just from a bail bondsman, but didn't have to have a judge involved or something. That we could not figure that one out.
Mm-hmm.
I was threatened with arrest only once, and that was on that march around the whole Olympic Village and everything. And we were in a back alley. We had kind of run out of directions to go, and we were looping back to get into the crowd. And in this back alley, of Officer L. Torres, initial L and last name Torres, wanted to know who the leader was, and then some Food Not Bombs people heard over the radio that they had identified me as the leader and that they knew all about me.
Mm-hmm.
And then that Torres finally got to me and said that I had to stop and talk to him and get out of the street, that we couldn't hold banners. Of course, the whole march just went past me and Mr. Torres and this other officer, and I kept kind of walking along with the march, and he said, okay, let's take this guy out. That'll end the protest. And so they reached for the handcuffs, but somehow they never ended up getting it together. They kind of tried to get behind me to grab me and stuff, but we just kept walking. And so it was not easy for them. So then they called for a paddy wagon and said, we're going to get a bunch of paddy wagons here and arrest all of you. They said, okay, and we just kept walking. And then Torres just walked away calling us. The last thing we heard is he was saying, we need a paddy wagon over here.
That was a little disorganized, huh?
Yeah, then we went to the end of the block and went back into the front of Centennial Park. And there was like 8 cops sitting on these chairs drinking sodas, and they just waved to us as we marched by. Had no connection to the cops on the other side. There were also Atlanta cops that had been hassling us. And then we just marched right through the main whole thing, you know, like no problem. Right through the main entrance we went, you know, within like 5 feet of where that bomb was.
Mm-hmm.
Right by with this huge Food Not Bombs banner unfurled, and about 8 banners, and about 75 people just marched right through the middle of the crowd, and the crowd was cheering, and the cops never dealt with us again.
Did any Olympic participants come over to Food Not Bombs and communicate with you?
Not that we would know. You couldn't really tell an Olympic participant and an Olympic observer. You know, I mean, they all look the same. Like a lot of people that are just tourists had shirts on that said they were in the Olympic gymnastic team for the U.S. and stuff, and you'd find out that they were just tourists that had bought Olympic gymnastic shirts.
How about foreign trade? Were many foreigners at the Olympics, and did they have much contact with Food Not Bombs?
Very few foreigners were there, and it was mostly the people that were there were the workers for IBM, Coca-Cola, and stuff that had been given tickets as part of or they got discount tickets through their jobs. And those were the people that were observing the Olympics, and they would have their corporate shirts on and stuff, you know, from whichever company. But they had been screwed by their companies, and that's why they were supportive of us. So,
now, last year at the UN 50th anniversary of Food Not Bombs' first international gathering, you published a kind of a newspaper every day. Did that happen again?
No, we published one calendar of events at the beginning. There, the resources for Xeroxing and publishing and faxing and phone calling were non-existent. It was very frustrating to... we eventually were able to print several thousand flyers that said, you know, what's behind the 1996 Olympic Games. And it was there was some definite disorganization amongst the... Now, my expectations and what I had read about from the left press out of Atlanta was that there were going to be, you know, I was told that there was 10,000 street heats that would be distributed to the crowds, but the director of that organization...
Street heat is?
It's like the, it would be like Street Spirit in
Oakland,
or the Street Sheet in San Francisco.
Yeah.
But it was, they were just stockpiled in this room and never released.
Wow.
So they never got out. They were still, when I left, which was day nine, they were still, there probably 9,000 copies of that paper were there, and only less than 1,000 had been distributed.
You brought back a copy with you, of course.
I hope I have a copy. That's possibly, I may not have a copy, actually.
So there were no arrests, and it was much different than the San Francisco Poonaw Bombs gathering last year. You were simply ignored, and was this a frustrating activity, or did you feel pleased that you were ignored? What was your reaction?
We had to acclimate to a lot of different environmental and problems. For itself, for instance, heat was a very high. We cooked and did everything outside in, 90-degree heat with a very high humidity and periodic thunderstorms. So we just kind of got, we would figure out exactly how much we could do, and what was amazing was how harmonious the Food Not Bonds people worked together. We were like, people were like so beautiful, and they're connecting with one another, and they're really deciding a finite thing that they could get together and then doing it and pulling off each event successfully. Like the poetry reading, over 100 people showed up to that with Dennis Brutus, and we heard the Atlanta, an international group of people from Amnesty International had toured the South and toured the United States investigating the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And people might recall back in the turn of the century in Atlanta, there was a huge gathering of activists opposed to the racist aspect of the death penalty and calling for an abolition of the death penalty. Here it was 96 years later, and this conference again was happening calling for an end of the death penalty. So that was fascinating to hear from people from Spain and from Holland and England denounce the inhumane practices of the U.S. justice system. And that was at this church in Decatur, which is a part of Atlanta. And Dennis Brutus spoke about his time in jail.
In South Africa?
In South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And how. And he denounced the current situation. You know, he said, well, it's great that there is no official apartheid in South Africa, but that's not good enough because there's economic apartheid, and that economic apartheid is not only a threat in South Africa, it's a worldwide threat, and that we really got to work for total revolution.
What was the situation with apartheid in Atlanta and in Food Not Bombs? What percentage of the people you were involved with were people of color, and what percentage were honkies?
It was mostly white people, really. There was like a few African-American people, but mostly white.
So there wasn't much cooperation with local black organizations, NAACP, and other civil rights groups?
Very little. We talked and were friendly with them, but when the only one protest, the burning of the Georgia state flag, was the only protest that had half African-Americans, half whites.
How about national protests around the welfare deformation bill that's going up before Clinton?
Well, at this event, there was no specifically targeting that. There was it was all protesting what the corporations had done primarily to the people of Atlanta and primarily to the homeless people of Atlanta.
And that's Keith McHenry of San Francisco. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, the August 2nd edition, actually, August 2nd, Friday, 1996. This is 96.3 FM, Free Radio. This is a recorded edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Our next interview is a continuation of one we began last show. Actually, it's sort of an update. Pat Ring talks about some of his activities in the last month. Pat, or Peppertongue Pat, as I call him, is one of the City Hall Sleepers Vigil supporters who's racked up an incredible amount of tickets in his few-month period of the vigil. Well, here, let's have him talk about it in his own words. Well, it's July 30th, 1996. It's the beautiful Pacific one-time garden mall, now the Pacific Garbage Mall. I'm here with Pepper Tongue Pat Ring, standing right across from Woolworths, in front of the homeless Revolutionary Coalition table. Everybody's number. Pat, here you are, about to leave town for L.A. to cause trouble, I understand, and, you know, you haven't even resolved your business here. Does that mean you're going to be ASOP or AWOL or whatever it is?
No, I would never do that. I'll be returning to take care of my little problems.
And those problems include, what, 8 or 9 tickets for contempt of court and assault, for heaven's sake, you vicious guy?
Well, yeah, well, a couple different cases. There's a case at the City Hall of contempt of court and having an illegal sign.
Yes, we recall that.
There's 22 camping tickets I've received at City Hall.
Right.
There's 2 misdemeanor arrests I received at City Hall for sleeping.
For sleeping. Right, in 48 hours.
Yes.
Punishable about to 6 months in jail.
Interesting, on those cases.
Under Rutkin's rules.
Those 2 misdemeanor arrests, I was arrested and released, and they didn't charge me with a misdemeanor. They charged me with an infraction. I've been to court probably 4 times on each case for infractions, okay? Recently, they changed them to misdemeanors again.
So they're trying to upgrade you.
Yeah, I appreciate it, because I actually was trying to get a misdemeanor on them. Anyway,
yours will be among the first misdemeanor sleeping trials in the history of Santa Cruz. We actually have, I guess, you, Faith Ian, Sean Alimi,
Mooncat.
And I guess Robert Flory.
Robert Flory and Sandy Ross.
Sandy Ross.
They refiled as a misdemeanor, similar to mine.
Let's walk this way.
And I can't walk that way.
Oh, okay.
I also have a little situation where I was arrested at City Hall. The mayor, Mike Rotkin, actually placed me under citizen's arrest. And I was charged with disturbing the peace.
I believe we spoke about that at the last free radio meeting. You were charged with disturbing the peace, and in fact, when you attempted to get OR'd, there was some sort of bail on you?
There was a bail. There was a $1,000 bail.
And you spent 5 days in jail over the weekend.
5 days in jail, and they refused to release me OR on my own recognizance. But they finally conceded to do that on the terms that I promised to stay away from City Hall and stay 100 yards away from Mike Rotkin.
Will City Hall stay away from you?
Apparently not. Anyway, I have another case. I was arrested at the courthouse in Division 8.
Commissioner Salazar's court.
No, Stevens.
Sorry about that.
Stevens.
Judge Stevens, Superior Court judge. But was he really superior?
No, he's actually really inferior. But more than him, his bailiff, Deputy Thurber, is really an inferior person.
Blackham Thurber, I remember.
Yeah. We were sitting in the courtroom. I was minding my own business. I noticed Deputy Thurber to be staring at me. So I politely turned to him and said, "Excuse me, sir, what are you looking at?" And he proceeded to throw me out of the courtroom.
How did he do this?
He came over and he told me to leave the courtroom. No, step outside is actually what he said. And I said, "Why? I haven't done anything." So he said, "Get out of the courtroom." And I told him, politely, very politely, "Fuck you."
Right.
And the judge asked me to leave, so I stepped out of the courtroom. Deputy Thurber followed me and asked me for my ID as I got outside and tried to grab my arm. Actually did grab my arm. And I walked away from him and was attempting to leave the area when he ran up behind me and grabbed my arm and twisted it behind my back.
Is this some sort of a thing he has for your arm? Is this a call to arms? He wanted to be in arm's way.
I don't know what his trip is. He's got a history of fucking with people. And
he does, it's true.
I don't like being fucked with. So we proceeded to get into a little
tussle,
yes. And he called for some of his friends, and they came running. And I proceeded to kind of get into a little tussle with Ken... deputy sheriffs.
Mm-hmm.
And in the course of this, Sandy Roth came outside and was telling them to leave me alone, at which time they threw her to the ground and handcuffed her and arrested her.
Any other witnesses to this?
Oh, yeah, there's a number of witnesses. We have three attorneys witnessed it. My three attorneys witnessed it.
Larry Hildes, Kate Wells, and
David Bouvet. Two citizens whose names escape me right now. I'm not sure of their names. Witnessed it. Dan Hopkins witnessed it.
The infamous Dan Hopkins.
Robert Flory. A number of people witnessed it. Anyway, I was arrested for four counts of contempt of court, five counts of assault, simple assault,
resisting
arrest and disturbing the peace.
Well, I think he only got me on, it was either three or five counts he arrested me on, but I wasn't as dramatic as you. I did was request that he give a, I'm going to tape record notice to the clerk of the court, which I usually do, a 980C notice, and his response was to have me arrested when I said, if you're not going to give it to the court, I will give it to the court.
I understood he had you arrested for theft, petty theft?
Right, petty theft was wrong because he felt I picked up one of his papers.
He's a hell of a guy, yeah.
A
notepad?
It was a piece
of scratch paper?
I picked up a piece of scratch paper in order to write down his name.
And he had you arrested for petty theft.
Well, it was pretty petty, I gotta say.
Yeah,
he was on the right track.
He's awfully petty. He's a real scumbag. And by the way, last summer for his vacation, Deputy Thurber went to South Africa on some kind of
Mercenaries R Us?
Yeah, some type of black man hunt.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, I see. Interesting. Where did you get this bit of information?
I can't say.
It's privileged information.
Yeah, I wasn't even supposed to talk about it.
Well, you know, at the last council meeting, some reference was made to your plight. In fact, I believe one individual actually had the temerity to make a speech.
Oh, and who would that be?
That was me, actually.
Oh.
And I wanted to present you with a copy of that speech.
Right on.
And for you to read, this is a speech at last Tuesday's city council meeting entitled Jail for Free Food in San Francisco,
Well,
Jail for Free Speech in Santa
Cruz.
I only
read things that have my name in it, so I will read this.
This does have your name in it, as well as your old friend Mayor Rotkin.
Oh, yeah, we go way back.
So any comments in concluding before my ride leaves without
I just want to say hi to Mike Rotkin and fuck you!
Thank you very much, Pat. And again, as usual, you're a man of few words.
Few words.
Thank you, sir, and have a good trip.
Thank you, Robert.
Well, I'm talking to that vicious political insider, Anonymous. And Mr. A, what is your solution for ending the sleeping ban?
I've got the solution. The solution is to get rid of Rotkin. That's the only way.
I see. You mean politically?
Vicious person. Vicious for Santa Cruz.
Right.
The answer is dump Rotkin.
I think many of us agree with you. Thank you, Mr. Anonymous. Hey, Leo! It's about 20 to 2, and I'm talking to
Thomas Groth.
Thomas, we're kind of in the back parking lot right outside Palace Art and Office Supply, and you just got out of jail.
2 weeks ago, sir.
And how long did you spend in jail?
Six months, because I went and made a modification.
And you were jailed for what offenses?
Two open containers and failure to appear, and they say under the influence.
Now, did they actually try you, or did you plead guilty?
I plead guilty.
And on whose advice did you plead guilty?
Nobody.
You just decided you wanted to plead guilty?
I wanted it over with.
Now, is this your first time in jail locally, or have you been jailed before?
No, sir. No, it's been for other same type little charges.
Ever been jailed for sleeping outside with a camping ticket?
No, but I've had tickets for it.
Are you sleeping outside now?
Yes, sir.
Any harassment from the police, or?
No, children. Little kids and people that are just in that area. They give me a hard time because I'm just trying to don't bother nobody. And you know what I'm talking about.
Any actual violent episodes?
Yes. This happened last year.
You're kind of rolling up your right sleeve here, so we can take a look at
it.
Rolling it down. Beg your pardon. Quite right.
And two Mexican kids got me right here.
Okay. I see kind of a horizontal scar across the mid arm of your right arm there.
Yeah.
And what happened?
I was asleep. I don't know.
Were you hit with something, or?
Yeah, they cut me, and I got three stitches above my eye, and it was all really just a headache more thing than anything else. I didn't
Now, were you say you were asleep. How did you know they were Mexican?
Their laugh when they ran down the railroad tracks. And I could read like a book.
How have police been treating him?
It's been 7 months, but I was more in a problem with them.
Of course, you've been in jail since then.
Yeah. A lot of them are good people. Once they know you, they're good. When you first start to know them, they're little kind of heartache, headache, assholes. But that's...
That goes with territory?
That's with their job, too, you know. It'd be the same way if I had their job. Well, so, you know, I'm not bad-mouthing these people. No.
How have things changed from when you went into jail? Are they the same? Are they different? How are conditions?
I just got out of jail 3 days ago because of a drunk in public. But that was only because I was tired. I went to sleep. They picked me up and let me go.
Where were you sleeping when they picked you up?
I don't recall.
I'm speaking to that man about coffee.
Yes. Hippus derelictus.
Now, you were talking a moment ago, we're actually kind of rounding up articles here for the Revolutionary Coalition newsletter, and you're talking about kind of contradictions in the system whereby people who are told to use methadone as a condition of their, probation, then can't use it in jail. What does all this mean?
It means that they don't allow it in the jail here. It's a medicine prescribed by a doctor, just like any other medicine, and that they... Because they don't believe in it in this county, they don't allow people that are heroin addicts that are trying to get off of heroin by using methadone instead to use it. And so then they have to go through great withdrawal, just the same as if they hadn't been withdrawing from heroin, only that it's worse. The withdrawal is worse. People kill themselves withdrawing from methadone.
How many heroin users would you say there are there in Santa Cruz City or County? Any estimates?
Users?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd say probably full-time, not shipping or anything like that, probably 600.
Yeah. And what's the extent of
population?
Yeah. Heroin use, according to, I just got out of jail, as you know, and many of the people are there for, you know, sales or use of heroin or crack. And according to what I'm told, use of heroin has just, you know, mushroomed in the last 10 years. It's like up 5 or 10 times. It's now being seen in small Midwestern towns where nobody ever heard of it before.
I don't believe that's true. I think that people have been using heroin. It's just more seen now. I think that the people have been using heroin underground for years. I used it for years, for 30 years. I used it for 30 years and nobody knew. I went through 8 wives and seven of them didn't know.
Really? So in other words, in the closet, so to speak.
Right, right. Executives, it's a great drug for an executive because it makes them totally objective and never subjective. They can have the perfect decision-making mind and never have to feel the pain of making the wrong decision or making a decision that's going to hurt them or hurt other people.
Well, I've often heard it said that heroin use, particularly by doctors who have easy access to it, doesn't impair their performance and, of course, doesn't impact on the community because often the problem with heroin lies in its criminalization and the fact that people have to rob in order to or be able to afford it.
Not even like
I
fire.
See that. I've had a habit of $300 a day. I've just been blessed with the ability myself to make money legally even up to $300, $400, $500, $600 a day if I need that to support my habit. But most people can't. Most people have to rob or whatever, steal.
In fact, I've even heard it said that magic cards are becoming a very strong currency. You heard of magic cards?
Yeah, I heard it.
Yeah, they're becoming a big favorite, and they were at least in the heat a couple of years ago in terms of purchasing drugs back and forth.
No kidding. Because I see my roommates have a lot of magic cards, and I don't think it's stupid. I mean, I'm...
Now you know, right?
Now I know they're heroin users and
they can be very valuable. Some of them aren't, but in fact only a few of them are. So
as a matter of fact, my roommates were so surprised about my heroin use I mean, that I'm not using, but that I do methadone, that they're, they need to want, they want to know everything about it, because they hear things that the media tells them or that the media doesn't know. Nobody really knows except for the methadone users themselves.
Now, what is unique, if anything, to the heroin scene here in Santa Cruz? You've been to different scenes, right?
Yeah, I don't think there's much uniqueness here.
It's pretty much the same as Santa Cruz is similar to San Francisco. Is there much violence associated with heroin use here?
Not really. There's not the only violence that really happens is where a person goes to the flats and doesn't like the size or the purity, so that they try to give it back and the Mexicans won't take it back, and so that causes a violent thing. But violence as far as use of heroin, there's more violence I see with cocaine and speed use.
Now, is heroin use bigger, you think, than cocaine and speed? Is it a different clientele?
Clientele.
Really? Now, what about the age of the heroin population, the heroin using population? I've heard a lot about younger users. For example, here's a young heroin user. No, just kidding. She's
no, as a matter of fact, I noticed that a lot of deadheads are heroin users, and I think it's because of Jerry Garcia was a heroin user, and so they
take after their Fuhrer.
Yeah, their Fuhrer, right. Take after their Fuhrer, and so I'm totally amazed to see these people using heroin that I never would suspect, especially in dreads and tie-dye and like that.
How about AIDS and heroin? Has there been mostly has there been any concern with hygiene and, you know, fuck safe, shoot safe kind of stuff? Or do you think there's a... Is there a large incidence of HIV positive and AIDS in the population here in Santa Cruz that uses heroin?
Well, I don't know. I think that the heroin users and the gay community are more aware of HIV and AIDS, so that it's way down there, whereas the heterosexual free love, the deadhead type, or deadbeats as I call them, they're the ones that are more apt to be getting AIDS, because they don't seem to care much about their, they share needles, they share women, share whatever, you know. It seems to be, if you want to catch something, go hang out with them, you'll catch it.
Now, what about the needle exchange in Santa Cruz? That's, of course, technically illegal, but presumably tolerated by police. Attorney General Dan Lundgren has declared he's going to go after needle exchange, and in some communities has actually moved to have it outlawed. Is it working effectively here in Santa Cruz? Have you ever used it? Do you know your friends use it?
I think that the needle exchange really works. I think that it's something that needs to be in every community, and that's a great deterrent for that. I mean, that's one of the best programs to come along in recent years as far as deterring AIDS or any other hepatitis C that nobody's even heard about until just recently.
Now, there's been some media coverage of a new treatment for heroin, which involves some kind of real fast, 48-hour, painless, I don't know what you call it, hot turkey treatment. Have you heard about that?
Cool.
I mean, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't involve any kind of pain. It involves you get shot up with something else. You get deep.
I heard about it. It's an 8-day treatment where they shoot you up with synthetic serotonin. That when you're using heroin, you do not manufacture serotonin, which is the drug in your brain that causes you to feel happy, to be able to sleep, to feel good about yourself, and that you quit manufacturing it when you're doing heroin. And so they figure out a way to re-enter serotonin into your body, synthetic serotonin, because they never had figured out another way, and that's supposed to be able to help you kick the habit painlessly.
And have you had any experience or heard of any experiences that give you any way of evaluating it?
I've only heard of one person that has ever even tried it, and that he said that after 8 days, he was fine for the 8 days, but on the 9th day, he felt terrible and had to go out and use.
Do you feel, you're a heroin user currently, do you feel that, you're not a heroin user currently, so there was a period in your, methadone, so you prefer that to heroin?
Absolutely not.
So, but the reason that you've changed is because of the illegality of it? Or is it
because? Yeah, it's because of the illegality of it. Right. That I'm tired of going to jail for having it in my possession or being under the influence of it, where a policeman can come to my house and go, you know what, I think that you're under the influence of heroin and take me to jail. They can knock on my door, when I open the door, take me to jail for being under the influence in my own home of heroin, and not even know they can take me to jail and then analyze it and hold me for 72 hours and find out, yes, you were high on heroin, so now we're going to hold you, and it's a mandatory 90 days if you're busted for being under the influence of heroin.
So you're, in essence, is a parole condition?
No.
Probation condition?
No, I'm not. I'm having to do it because I cannot stay clean on my own. The longest I ever stayed clean on my own was 6 years. If by doing methadone for 3 years and then I'm able to stay clean on my own for another 6 years in 1 day, I think that I've accomplished something again. And I'll gladly do that.
Has heroin badly impacted your health, your heroin use, or has it had no impact on your health?
None. I'm more healthy, I think, than most people. I've never
had. What about the coffee roasting company's rather potent brew of coffee? Has that impacted your health?
No, I only always use the vast cup.
Let's see. Any other words for Free Radio Santa Cruz you wish to share with us before we go shoot up? Just kidding about that.
Yeah, well, don't take heroin. It's definitely warm, dark, and fuzzy.
There you have it. Straight from the lion's mouth. Thank you very much.
Get the Sterilictus.
So clarify that again about what you can have in what counties and what you can't in this county.
In San Francisco and in Santa Clara, if you're currently on the methadone program and you go to jail, you can have your methadone. And here in Santa Cruz, they don't believe in it, methadone. And that, as a matter of fact, last time I went to jail and they knew I was on methadone, when the judge was going to go OR me, the DA said, don't OR him because he's on methadone, and if we hold him for 2 weeks, he'll be ready to go for anything that we offer him because he'll be in such pain.
And is your story a unique one?
No, that's the way it is with all the methadone users. They use it, once they get you in jail, they use it to as if it were, you know, Pavlov's bell or shock treatments or whatever, because at the end of 2 or 3 weeks, you have not had any sleep at all. You have not been asleep at all. Not a minute, not a second. So you've been awake that whole time in enormous pain and cramps and runs and all that stuff, like the flu, but you have these other incredible pain. So instead of it, the real cruel and unusual punishment about it is that somebody is given 30 days in jail, they get to sleep half the time. So they're really only doing 15 days or half of 30 days, whereas a person on methadone or heroin, they're kicking that. They have to do the whole 30 days because they don't get to sleep.
Any estimates of how many people are in jail currently in the Santa Cruz County Jail for heroin use, or how many
are
using heroin, or who are, shall we say, under the impact of this methadone deprivation?
Methadone or heroin deprivation? Well, methadone deprivation, I don't know. I say it at any given time, there's probably 10 of methadone deprivation.
Out of what, 400 people in the jail? Or?
Yeah. That's not very a lot of methadone deprivation, but there's probably 60 of heroin.
Have you approached any or formed any organizations of former users or users who are concerned with civil rights for folks in jail or folks out of jail who are either heroin addicted or methadone addicted?
Absolutely, I have, but people, just like most people, that realize you can't sue the police or in the county that you live in, because they can make it very hard on you, very rough, and especially if you're on methadone, they're making it 10 times as rough as a normal person. And all they have to do is put you in jail for 4 days, and you are in great pain, and they didn't even do nothing. All they did was hold you in jail.
They're torturing you,
literally torturing you. As if in the Middle Ages of torturing you. They could be whipping you or whatever.
If anyone wants to, are you interested in forming an organization to help fight this?
Absolutely I am. And in that, I talk to lots of them, and they're all for it, but they want to be anonymous about it too. They don't want to let their names, unless they had somebody like the ACLU actually standing up for them, then they'd be willing to be let their names be known and be more vocal.
Well, anyone who wants to is interested in this organization can contact our anonymous speaker here through my phone number, which is 423-HUFF, 423-4833. We're, of course, speaking on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Assuming our station is still on the air, we're having some difficulties. But if it is, do give a call to 423-HUFF if you're interested in this issue, and I'll attempt to put you in touch with a potential organization here. Thank you. And as if one interview with Keith McHenry were not enough, here's an interview that's even more recent, and I guess this one talks more, I think, about San Francisco than about Atlanta. Let's hear what Keith has to say in part two of the McHenry tapes, or is it part 947?
About as fat as I am.
Oh, no.
Oh, dear. So, Keith, you're back in town. Food Not Bombs is back on the swing shift, and you got a call from Amnesty International.
Yeah, they'd called because they'd read a press account that you had been released from jail, and they wanted to know if that was true, and we said yes, that you had been released from jail, and that, well, I thanked them and told them that I thought that definitely some of what they had been doing had contributed to...
What have they been doing?
Well, apparently they did write a bunch of letters to the governor and to the mayor and things like that, and... tried to hassle them into...
Did they get any responses from Mayor Brown or Governor Wilson in regards to my jailing for serving free food?
No, they don't really actually communicate with the with anybody, those people, apparently.
Hmm.
They just, but they, you know, I still nonetheless thank them because they did, you know, I'm sure in the whole mix of things between that, your political organizing in jail itself and the vigil out in front, that it's just that, you know, the people in power, needless to say, are not going to admit that political organizing works.
Mm-hmm.
But it does. And, and in fact, that's the only thing that works, because nothing else works. The courts don't work.
The political process of elections doesn't work?
Yeah, that certainly doesn't work. Look at that. That's like, and this is a great election for showing how stupid that kind of stuff is.
Now, what about the political organizing going on in San Francisco? You have upcoming events you want to speak about, or?
Well, the main thing that I'm working on right now, and this is something that it would affect, and hopefully that people in Santa Cruz would be interested in, is the National Day to Protest Police Brutality. And
that's in October, right?
That's October 22nd. We have a regional organizing meeting in San Francisco on Tuesday the 13th.
Of August
to start planning for this last final push.
Where and when is that?
That's going to be on Tuesday the 13th at 7 o'clock at 2940 16th Street on the third floor. That's the building where the Wobbly's office is in San Francisco, near it's at the corner of Cap and 16th. That's the old labor building, Redstone building.
Now, we talked a few months ago about how there had been a change in the upper levels of the police bureaucracy. We had a new police chief, Lau, possibly a new deputy police chief. And we also supposedly had something of a new policy. Food Not Bombs food was occasionally being confiscated at political events. And you had one arrest, you yourself, the day after I went into jail. But other than that, Food Not Bombs has been left pretty much alone. Is that still the case?
Yes, it has been, although the group itself has been kind of a little on the fritz as well. So it's we don't have a super high
profile
on the streets, unfortunately, which is can contribute to this. There is a number of issues, however, and I think the Food Not Bombs potentially could get busted, although the mayor has definitely said he is opposed to Food Not Bombs getting arrested.
No, that was in the Washington Post article you're talking about?
Correct, in the Washington Post article, and he's made a number of other such public statements to the media. So he's in a situation where he has said these one things, although he is also a famous mayor, already famous for reversing his opinion. So you can never quite tell what's going on.
So where has he reversed his opinion? This is, we're talking to Mayor Willie Brown.
Yeah, this is Willie Brown has done some things like he was opposed to, he's done a number of different things. Like there was, there's a number of campaign promises he made, which once in office, he reversed it.
Specifically?
Like, for instance, the destruction of a of the overhead, like the Fell Street ramp off of 101. You know, he was against that being torn down, and now is in just a favor of it being torn down. That it's mostly really boring things around construction projects and things that he's reversed himself on.
Well, has he actually carried out his February 28th promise to stop the harassment of the Matrix?
That he has not, and that is the real new frontier. Independent, which I call the paper that's, like if you're in San Francisco, everyone knows it as the paper that wraps around your legs as you walk down the street because
mm-hmm.
it just is essentially garbage.
It's a giveaway paper that appears on everybody's doorstep.
Yeah, and it's just, it's
twice a week or something.
Three times a week, and it's probably responsible for 50% of the litter on the streets of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a conservative newspaper, and it is running this whole article about there's a new policy being proposed to give 24 hours notice to homeless people of their property being seized.
Now, this is right. This is in a series of negotiations with the Coalition on Homelessness, which has been endlessly extended throughout the spring and summer, and also apparently is sort of coordinated with this. Well, at the same time, small claims court suits are being decided on behalf of the homeless
right.
for property stolen by police.
Correct. There was, I think, about eight people who have won so far damages for having confiscated property. Of course, the state of California law, I still believe, is the same as it had been several years ago, which is that it's really supposed to be held for 30 days, and there's been some back and forth as to whether it's really 90 days or 45 days or... But I think it eventually in a series of court cases was determined that it was really 30 days. So holding something for 24 hours, which is sort of what is being currently proposed, or at least what the Independent is claiming.
Didn't they say they were going to simply leave a 24-hour warning and then come back in 24 hours?
That is what it sounds like is opposingly the program, although then later in the article you get this impression that it's... that you can get your property back from police within 24 hours. So it's unclear exactly.
Mm.
Of course, it's relatively difficult to leave a notice for, I guess what they'll do is they'll put like a flyer on whatever they see and say,
sort of like a yellow tagging a vehicle.
A vehicle, yeah. So if they did do that, that would certainly be a step up from what has been going on.
Any reports on ticketing for sleeping and lodging and so forth, or the usual harassment stuff happening around Golden Gate Park, Civic Center Plaza, the Tenderloin?
Well, all of that is still at a heightened level, and there's still cop watches, or the street watch is still seeing a lot of confiscations of property still, and ticketing and arrests for people that are involved in crimes, so-called, because of their economic condition. Crimes are going to the bathroom outside, sleeping outside. And
what about the new toilets that are blanketing
A lot of them
the
are
city.
Not working, unfortunately, still, which is kind of unfortunate. I know the one, for instance, at 16th and Mission, is you can use it, but you have to use it with the door wide open and everyone watching you.
Oh, well, sort of a public approach to
yes,
the whole question.
But because it's somehow the door is stuck open.
Well, this could be the French approach, ooh la la. No.
Right, that's a whole new trend. So that, I don't know if that's considered public urination or not, but you are urinating in the public.
Mm-hmm.
Then the it's also, there's an interesting article in this week's San Francisco Weekly about Andy Olson, who is the person who runs the homeless coordinator's position for the mayor,
mm-hmm.
a job that, after reading this article, I certainly would like to have. It's $75,000 a year, and I'm thinking of sending a letter and saying, well, if you fire Andy, hire me, because I could use that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, nothing's going on with it. And, of course, this was an article written by Malcolm Garcia, formerly of the Tenderloin Self-Help Center, and the editor of By No Means.
Oh, whatever happened to By No Means? That was a kind of a monthly publication that really had a lot of interesting stuff.
It was a fantastic publication, but it's that they had ties with the city government, and of course, anybody with ties to the city government eventually got jerked around, and they got cut because of that. That's a good reason not to have financial entanglements with governments that you're opposed to.
On the other hand, those, for example, like yourself and Food Not Bombs, that financial entanglements are yet waiting to see the next issue of the Food Not Bombs menu come out, which is,
right.
Should we say, what, 2 months behind schedule?
It's at least 2 months behind. It's very frustrating because, I mean, right now I'm in a position of the Food Not Bombs vehicle that, well, I use my vehicle to do Food Not Bombs and my truck, and it's, like, dead as a result of doing that, and I'm, like, trying to repair it now, and I'm like hundreds of dollars short on being able to actually get my truck out of the repair shop.
So send your dimes and dollars to...
to 3145 Geary Boulevard, number 12, San Francisco, 94118.
Repeat that address.
And, it's Food Not Bombs, 3145 Geary Boulevard, G-E-A-R-Y, number 12, San Francisco, 94118, and we do have like a tax ID number that's through the Coalition on Homelessness. The other thing that we would like to get a menu out fairly soon, and we're trying to...
By a menu, you're referring to the kind of news publication that describes Food Not Bombs' adventures in all the 130-odd cities where it has chapters, right?
Correct, right. It's a... this has been published now for the entire 16 years of Food Not Bombs, although originally it was more like an actual menu, because we used to print up a couple of thousand 8.5 by 11 two-sided flyers that had the listing of the food that we were going to serve at some protest, and then other news about Food Not Bombs or other events. Now it's a 50-page publication that's 8.5 by 11 two-sided. It's a 25 pages two-sided, 50 total pages. That's mailed to all the Food Not Bombs chapters, and they do contribute for the postage, which has been a big help. But many chapters are broke, as broke as we are. And one of the things we'd like to include is the news about Quebec City Food Not Bombs. Three Food Not Bombs members there have just been released from jail because the jail was flooded.
Rather than supply snorkels and underwater gear, I guess.
And then we received reports yesterday from Brock from Quebec City Food Not Bombs that the police have been going around to the punk rockers and to the other people in the community asking if they know anything about either Quebec Food Not Bombs people or Montreal Food Not Bombs. And they've been also, the provincial police have been in Montreal questioning people. And the police have actually admitted that they're doing an investigation on Food Not Bombs in Quebec province. In conjunction with an attempted overthrow of the Quebec provincial government. And
so Food Not Bombs is apparently becoming a kingmaker, attempting to overthrow the government in order to set up its own carrot heads.
I don't know what the provincial government there thinks in reality, because it's really silly, but they are generating a lot of French and English media in Canada. I'm receiving a lot of calls from up there, people interested in joining Food Not Bombs because they've been accused of overthrowing the...
Well, tell them to kick in a couple $100 for your newsletter. I'm getting tired of waiting here at my post office box.
But it's a good newsletter, right?
It is a good newsletter. When it comes out, the last one was May 16th or some such thing.
We got one out, and it was the end of May, I think it was. It was like May 29th or something like that.
Really? Well, maybe you got two out in May.
No. Well, maybe it was the 16th, but that's our last one was in May. It was an attempt to try to help promote interest in attending the protests in Atlanta. and also to share. There's a lot of new chapters happening. For instance, not only is there the arrests and so on that are going on in Canada, two computers were seized by the provincial government that are really for a local newspaper that's there. Anarchist zine that Funabombs is connected with, and it had the mailing list of all, for that zine and so on. So that's like very much like the McCarthy era type raids.
Now, what about California? We had what was her name?
Carrie Chandler is still awaiting her last court appearance was yesterday. Yeah, yesterday, and I have not gotten a call from her yet.
We're talking about a woman in Whittier who's being taken to trial for serving free food without a permit, a somewhat familiar charge.
Correct.
And I guess they had dropped the first charge against one of her colleagues, but she's still facing that charge, and we had thought they were going to drop the second one, but you don't know that they have.
Yeah, they may have, because we did not get any news, so...
maybe no news is good news.
Right, that's what I mean. Now, one last thing is I did receive a fax from Michael Kaplan in Montreal and around the issue of homelessness in Montreal and this protest that happened on July 29th. And it says, I can't read some of it, which is unfortunate, but it said on Monday, July 29th at 5:30 to 9 o'clock a.m., approximately 70 persons were arrested.
And that's it for Bathrobe Spears Broadsides today, the shortened edition. Next edition, you'll hear who was arrested for what, when, where, how, and why. That's on Monday, 10 o'clock on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This tape we may loop over because we're kind of a loopy group here, particularly with the studio being tied up. So if you want to hear the tape...
Days in the county jail, hold my calls, hold my mail, serving soup, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. I have a shop on a street in town where hungry folks walk up and down. Some have no homes, some sick from want. So I went and got some food from a restaurant. I took it to a central spot to feed the weary something hot. The police came, took me away. Now for my awful deed I must now pay. With 30 days in the county jail, hold my calls, hold my mail, serving soup, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. They said I needed a permit to serve free food. It must be fit. Now here I am awaiting trial while the hungry have to eat from the garbage pile. It's 30 days in the county jail. Hold my calls, hold my mail. Serving soup, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. I faced the judge and I made my plea. He looked away when he sentenced me. He said, we won't put you in the hole if you promise not to feed another living soul. I told that judge I could not say that crazy law I would obey, nor pay no fine or post no bail. Now I'm feeding folks inside the county jail. 30 days in the county jail. Hold my calls, hold my mail. Serving soup, that was my crime, that was my crime. Well, instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. Well, now Wally North lied under oath. He lied to the judge and the Congress both. He was running drugs for the Contra War, but they locked me up because I fed the poor. Our leader, George, you know he might be right when he sees 1,000 points of light with kinder, gentler hearts like mine. But now there's just 999. 30 days in the county jail. Hold my call, hold my call, hold my mail, hold my mail. Serving soup, that was my crime, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time.
That is great, and you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, Bathrobe Spears Broadside, Civil Rights for Everybody in Town. And we have a recorded version of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides because the station is in motion at the moment. As you will hear later in an interview on this show, I hope, if I can get the proper